Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassam. Recently, I have been recollecting a conversation I had, this is quite a few years ago now, with a Christian monk who came to visit us here. I think if I remember correctly, he lives in a hermitage somewhere just north of here on the border between Northumberland and Scotland. And what I remember distinctly about this conversation really stuck with me was we were talking about Christian folk who come to visit him there looking for support in their spiritual life, and I took the opportunity to ask him, I said, do you teach these people who come to see you how to pray? Because I remember, having been brought up as a Christian myself, that, you know, you're supposed to do this thing called prayer, and yet we're never really taught how to do prayer. You know, what are you supposed to do there? There's asking for this, asking for that. I mean, how do you really go about praying? And his reply was really interesting. He said, oh no, prayer is not something you're taught, it's caught. It's like it's cold. You hang around somebody who's got it and you pick it up. That's a really different perspective on spiritual education. And obviously, catching a cold is not something that's desirable. At the moment, there's a cold going through this community here. Somebody came to visit with a cold, and somebody got a cold, and somebody else got a cold, and now quite a few people in the monastery have got a cold, or caught a cold. And that's undesirable. What is desirable is being introduced to a truly different and meaningful appreciation on what spiritual life is about. So what came out of that, I later reflecting on it, and what I think about it these days is it's the difference between instruction and induction. You can have all the instruction in the world, read about, hear about spiritual teachings, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upekkha. You can know about all these things and the 12 links of dependent origination. And does it really make a difference? And what is it that really makes a difference? When Ajahn Chah was visiting America, obviously many years ago now, he was staying at a meditation retreat center, and he reported how generally he was impressed with the enthusiasm of these American meditators, very disciplined, turning up on time for the sitting meditation sessions and really interested. However, there was one series of question and answer sessions where, well, I think there was quite a few of them, and people are, what about this Lumpur? What about that Lumpur? And can you explain this and can you explain that? And in the end, Lumpur Cha's reply was, look, he said, I've been living in a monastery since I was, 12, 13, 14 years old or whatever. And you don't just go on a meditation retreat for a couple of weeks and expect to understand this stuff. And if you want to understand this stuff, you come and live with me for a few years, and then you'll catch on or pick it up. So it's worth considering this in our relationship with information or instruction about meditation, or information and instruction about the spiritual life, because there is so much information and instruction around. Is it the same thing as being inducted into a new perspective on experience, one that makes a tremendous difference, a really significant difference? This is not to say that there's not a place for instruction. It's like saying there's not a place for Pariyatti Dhamma, or the Buddha's teachings on the theory of the spiritual life. And of course there's a place for Pariyatti, of course there's a place for instruction. my first meditation retreat that I went on. If the teacher hadn't given instruction, he said, okay, we're going to be silent for a week, keeping the 8 precepts, sit in silence, walk in silence, and that was it. Maybe do a little chanting. Then no way would I have benefited the way that I did on my first meditation retreat. Somebody persuaded me to go on this retreat in a little dusty town in the north of New South Wales in Australia. It didn't exactly drag me along, it did take a bit of persuasion because I wasn't particularly interested. I'd met the monk who was teaching the retreat. I met him when I was in Sydney, and I confess I wasn't overly impressed, and so there seemed to be a lot of do's and don'ts, and I was, 21 years old or 22 years old, and I wasn't particularly interested. Anyway, I was persuaded to go on this meditation retreat, and then was the instruction that he gave, this monk, the same monk that I found not very impressive, I'm embarrassed to say, to whom I'm incredibly indebted and so grateful. Just very simple, basic meditation instruction. You know, how to pay attention, how to discipline attention. And we have this experience of attention. If we don't discipline attention, if we just let it go any which way, then it remains weak, it's dissipated. If we discipline attention, it turns to something else. And the instruction in itself, yes, I sat there and I listened to it. What made the difference was applying it. And then, with sincerity, I can still remember on the third day of this retreat, I was doing walking meditation out on the road, hot Australian sunshine, walking up and down the road, and then something shifted in a way that I was not expecting. There was this moment of quietness. My mind was pretty busy normally, and thinking about this and thinking about that and comparing and analyzing and speculating. Just applying the discipline of attention consistently for a wee while, walking up and down, and then I just, this impression arose, and the thought arose, there's just knowing, or there's just awareness. I forget which word it was, or something. This observation, there's just knowing. Not all this blah, blah, blah noise that usually goes on in my mind. There's just knowing. And then it was followed very quickly, spontaneously, by another thought, which was, who knows? And that precipitated another dropping into a deeper level of calm, which was very new and very agreeable. That was different. That was relevant. And that had far-reaching consequences and changed, I would say, changed the course of my life. It's probably because of that that I ended up traveling across Australia through Indonesia, Malaysia, and then ended up living in Thailand for 4 or 5 years, and for which, again, I'm enormously grateful and feel tremendously privileged to have had that opportunity. The instruction itself is not the point. It's what it inducts us into. It's the shift in appreciation on our experience that matters. So let's remember this. We're not just talking about accumulating more information, because that's the way we're taught. That's the normal education that we get in school. Information, education, information makes a difference. It does make a difference. It equips us with all sorts of possibilities. Now, without the possibility, without the education, without the instruction, of course, we're limited. Though if we focus too much and we get greedy for information, because it can feel so good, and I can still remember again my first Buddhist book I read, I thought, this is amazing. I've never come across anything like this. It was a book by Alan Watts, The Way of Zen. This is back in the very early 70s, 1971, 72, something like that. There weren't many Buddhist books around in those days. This one was being circulated, and a friend of mine gave it to me, and I'd never come across anything like this before. It encouraged questioning. And my spiritual education had been, believe. If you believe in this, then everything's going to be okay. Don't ask any questions. Just believe in this, and it'll all be okay. And because the way my mind worked, I didn't believe anything very easily. I doubted. I questioned stuff, big time. And this teaching, this Buddhist teaching, encouraged questioning, encouraged inquiry. And that was new. And that and a few other points that the book made really inspired me. I would say it was because of that that I ended up going on that meditation retreat. And as I said, changed the direction of my life. Though I think the point I want to make is that when we have these initial inspirations, and it gives us a new level of conceptual understanding, oh right, there is this way. The Buddha's teachings are different from the other religions, most of the other religions in the world, the belief systems. It's not merely about believing that somebody else has the authority to control your life, that there's an external agent that's going to take responsibility for you. It's a different orientation of effort. It's an encouragement to turn attention inwards towards our hearts, not going out after imagining what's going to happen in the future. We can still do that, of course. That's valuable. Speculating about the future, that's helpful. Remembering the past, that's helpful. What the invitation in this path of practice amounts to, though, is disciplining attention to inquire inwards to what is this experience that I'm having right now? What is the nature of this experience? Do I have to be lost in this experience if it's joyous or if it's miserable? Is this all there is to me? Is this my identity? Is this my true identity? Is this truly who and what I am? Like that meditation retreat that I was on, the moment of peacefulness, that experience of peacefulness, and then fortunately the question of, but who knows or who is aware, that was really helpful. That inquiry, that questioning precipitated, it seems, another shift and another level of appreciation on experience. So let's be careful that we don't just focus on the initial good feelings that come from having confidence in the theory of Dhamma. It's like the forms. Sometimes people come to the monastery and they look at the beautiful Buddha image and they smell the beautiful incense and they think, oh, this is such a beautiful place. Well, that's true, it is a beautiful place. However, that's not the point. The real beauty to be focused on is not the external form, it's the opportunity to ask real questions of ourselves that take us in a real and truly relevant direction, inwards. Being intoxicated by the outer appearance. Again, this is not just a modern dysfunction or a Western disorder. This is normal for unawakened human beings. There's a recorded story in the scriptures. In fact, if I remember correctly, it's recorded in several locations in the scriptures and reported somewhat differently each time. It's about this monk called Wakali, who, it seems, was overly enamored with how good-looking the Buddha was. You know, he would just sit and stare at the Buddha, because apparently the Buddha was very beautiful in his outer appearance. And this went on for quite a long while, until the Buddha said, okay, well, this is enough of that. That's maybe even too much of that, and sent him away, and pointed out to him, before he sent him away, pointed out, if you want to see the Buddha, you have to see the Dhamma. That's the spirit. That's deeper. That's not the outer form. Yeah. We can get intoxicated by the outer form, And if we've been living in a position of confusion or a situation that's particularly unpleasant or disagreeable, and we come across something that's very agreeable, like a new set of ideas or a spiritual community, people that we feel we share an aspiration with, it can be a wonderful relief, a real gift. Let's not get stuck there, because that's not the point. That's the handshake, it's not the relationship. That's the introduction. That's not the point. It can be interesting, it can be beautiful, it can be encouraging. We don't want to get stuck on the Buddha. He said, if you want to see the Buddha, you see the Dhamma. Disciplining attention and examining very sensitively the relationship we have with experience. All experience, sight, sound, smell, taste, touches and mental impressions, all of it. Liking, disliking arises. Can we study liking and disliking? Are these reactions of liking and disliking, wanting and not wanting, are these who and what we are? Normally that's what we feel. If I like something, I like it. Really, that's who and what I am. I like it, and if I get it, then I am happy. And if something comes along that I don't like, somebody behaves in a certain way and I don't like it, and I don't agree, and I don't approve, and that feels like I. Really, I don't agree with this. And that's my, often, usually, that's my identity. The Buddha wanted us to realize that's not a secure identity. That's a false identity. It's like that image I've given many times before. If you've got a wound on your forehead and you look in the mirror and then you put cream on the mirror, that's crazy. That's not going to help the wound on the forehead. We do that because we think the image of who we are is what we really are. The idea of who we are, the persona, the personality, is an approximation of who and what we are. It's got a place, it's functional, we use it. And it's around that we have this sense of I configured. However, the Buddha wanted us to go deeper than that and inquire very carefully, very skillfully, to feel beyond the outer appearance of this I. When I get what I want, I feel gratified, I feel happy, and that feels secure. When I don't get what I want, I feel unhappy, I feel insecure. And if we think that's all there is to life, then we just struggle backwards and forwards with wanting and not wanting, liking and disliking. The instruction that we're given is really aimed at not just giving us a sense of security by having ideas that approximate accurately with reality. It's rather to change our relationship with experience. And even though it's true that when we get used to the pleasure that comes from feeling confident about our ideas about the world, about experience, about who we are, about the Dhamma, and we can feel confident in that, we can also become addicted to it. And it keeps us restless, always restless. Like we feel uncertain about something. And as a result of a lack of mental clarity and confidence, the feeling of uncertainty arises and we don't like it. And I want to feel sure. Now, where is that? What is that? That I want to feel sure. Yes, it's got something happening in our heads, the thought I want to feel sure. However, there's fire, there's movement, there's something deeper in the body, in our hearts. That's what we need to be looking at. That's where we need to go. And to feel that ache of longing, the ache of longing for certainty, the ache in the heart, in the chest, in our body. Not just the mental confusion we're caught up in the smoke that is our thinking mind. Come down and to really exercise what we have hopefully developed, our embodied mindfulness and our skillful intentional composure. sati and indriya samvara, the powerful tools that we need to hone down our skill in using and apply this to the very fire, the ache. No judgment. This is a struggle. It's a virtuous struggle. This is a virtuous struggle. This is a relevant struggle. This is a struggle. There's a point to this. We can learn something from this if we don't just react against the disagreeability, the dukkha, to use the Buddhist language, and really meet it. There may be a shift in our relationship to wanting to feel sure will take place, not just because we looked at a book or went to see a teacher and got an answer, rather our addiction to that synthetic security that comes from being identified in thinking shifts. And for that to happen, there needs to be a willingness to dare. There needs to be a willingness to be daring and to risk, to take risks. The spiritual journey is a risky business. We protect ourselves with our commitment to keeping precepts, and hopefully if we can, surrounding ourselves with spiritual companions, and these are protections that we have in this journey. However, it's still risky, and it still feels risky to let go of the initial good feeling that we have from having ideas lined up. Oh, this is what it's about. This is what the Buddha was talking about. Right? If they're just ideas, that's just instruction. That's not enough. So if we want to deepen in practice and grow in confidence, then we need to dare to let go of that and take it to another level. And when I think about this, it's like the image that comes to my mind is like when if you're downloading onto your computer or you're downloading onto your smartphone a new app, you've heard about this app or you've read about this app and it looks really neat. Okay, this is a nice tool, and you download it. That's the instruction. The induction, the point of it, is using it, is applying it. If all we do is just fill our phone up with apps and don't ever use them, then we're really missing out. Likewise, if all we do is focus on the outer form of Buddhism, on the instruction, then we're really missing out. Thank you very much for your attention.